Okay, one thing I wanted to do at the beginning is to go over what I knew was a very challenging question on the test. At least part of it was very challenging. Part of it was hardly challenging at all in the sense that you all got the assignments right, A, B, C, D. I think everyone got all of them right, so I was pleased with that. But there's this exam is this this example was chosen in part because it has a subtlety that separates the men from the boys, as they say. And I knew it was hard, and some people got all or most of it, but not very many. So I thought it would be worth spending just a few minutes at the top of the lecture to show you this. Okay, so these signals for B and D, the ethyl group, show a 1:2:1 triplet with 7 hertz splitting, which is everybody got the signals of the methyl groups, but by the CH2 next door, and a 1:3:3:1 triplet or a quartet for the CH2 group that's split by the 3 hydrogens next door. And of course, the splittings have to be the same. 7 hertz in the one signal and the other. If two things are splitting, if A splits B, interacts magnetically, the same sequence of electron correlations that get from one nucleus to the other go this way and the other way. So you get exactly the same energy of influencing of A on B and B on A. So the two splittings are both 7 hertz, which isn't surprising. Okay, but then there was this crazy doublet splitting on top of that, and several people raised the possibility that that 3 hertz doublet could be due to long-range splitting interaction between B and A across the top here. Now that's through 1, 2, 3, and then the bond out to hydrogen, 4 bonds, whereas these 7 hertz splittings are all 3 bonds. I wasn't too surprised that you said that, because it's not right. Because we talked about long-range splitting. If you have a double bond, for example, in between, you can get splittings through 4 bonds. But this doesn't have a double bond, but what did you know? Maybe an oxygen could do the same kind of trick as a carbon-carbon double bond. It can't. But that's, I didn't expect you to know that. But one thing that you could have seen is that there is no splitting of the A signal. So if A splits B with that little weak 3 hertz splitting, then B must also split A. Right? There has to be a quintet for the, remember there are 4 B hydrogens here, so 4 of them will be splitting that signal, and it would be a quintet. So it would be a really complicated thing, all those 3 lines of the triplet, each of them would be a quintet with small splitting, and all this thing would be a sort of forest all on top of one another, but that's not there. That the A signal shows just the 7 hertz triplet from the CH2 proton C here. Right? So there isn't long-range splitting. Of course, I realize that you might have gotten it if you'd had more time than you had on the test. That's a subtle thing to see. But it's an important lesson that if A splits B, B will split A. Okay? So what is the source of that splitting? Well, let's make this carbon here more realistic, show it as tetrahedral rather than the projection that was shown on the exam. And then you notice that there's symmetry in the top of the molecule is symmetric at the bottom. In fact, there's a mirror plane that's perpendicular to the stream that goes down there. Okay? So now tell me, what's the relationship between a group on the top and a group on the bottom? For example, this hydrogen with this hydrogen, this oxygen with this oxygen, this CH2 with this CH2, and blah, blah, blah. Or the whole ethyl group, or this whole ethoxy group with this whole ethoxy group. What's the relationship between them? Are they identical? Are they superimposable? Matthew, what do you say?
Well, they're not superimposable.
Yeah, they're enantiotopic. they're you could call them enantiomers. That's usually talked about with molecules. Enantiotopic talks about the environment in which things find themselves. So the top is enantiotopic with the bottom, and a number of people mentioned the enantiotopicity. Now, would that give a difference between the groups on the top and the groups on the bottom in the NMR, the fact that the groups are enantiotopic? Might this one, for example, that H, have a different chemical shift from that H, for example? Or, in particular, might this CH2, signal B, have a slightly different chemical shift from this CH2, so that that splitting could be due to different chemical shifts, since it seems hard to figure out, hard to assign it to a spin-spin splitting, because if you have it here, you have to have it in whatever other proton is causing the spin-spin splitting, and you don't see that. Okay? So, Ely, you tell me, do you think this one and that one would have the same chemical shift or not? Yeah, you're right. They would. Mirror images would have almost all their properties in common. So they'd have identical chemical shifts. So that's not going to explain the difference from the top to the bottom, usually. There would be a special way of doing the experiment where they could have different enantiotopic groups could have different chemical shifts. And somebody, I forget who it was, but one or two people mentioned that. How could you make things that are mirror images behave differently? Whoever said it on the exam could say it now. I don't remember who it was. Mike? Can't hear? How could you make diastereomers out of those things that are mirror images in their environment without doing a reaction? Mustafa? If the solvent were chiral, right, then whatever weak interaction there is with the solvent, if the solvent were all not only chiral but resolved, right, only one enantiomer, then the interactions of the solvent with those two would be somewhat different. Right? In fact, if you got a benzene ring with a substituent that made it chiral and had a single enantiomer, then you could imagine that the benzene ring would be closer to one than to the other, and the diamagnetic anisotropy, the ring current of the benzene, could make one chemical shift. That would be an example. But any chiral solvent in principle could do that. So, but this is not a case. So, those are enantiotopic, and they have the same chemical shift unless there's a chiral resolved solvent or some other reagent they could interact with that was chiral and resolved. Okay, but that's not the case here. Okay, and if that were the case, it would be a little surprising if only B showed it and none of the others. Right? Because why wouldn't the others be different too, the mirror images top and bottom? Okay, so that's not a good... I mean, it was nice that you thought of it and I gave you credit, but it's not the right answer. Okay? Now, so if that's not it, what else could be... It looks like it's a chemical shift difference, right? Not spin-spin splitting, because there's nothing else that shows that 3-hertz splitting, right? But let's think about those two hydrogens. Are those two equivalent? Things are equivalent top to bottom, or more properly, mirror images top to bottom, groups up here and groups down here. But how about the two hydrogens of that CH2 group? Do they have equivalent environments? Well, let's look at those. Suppose you made one of them deuterium. Right, that's a test of whether things are... You get one enantiomer or the other if you change two equivalent things, a prochiral center. Is that center prochiral? Would there be handedness if you replaced one of them by D? Yes, indeed there would. That carbon would be chiral. So then, at first glance, you'd say, aha, those two positions then, the one replaced by D and the H, are enantiotopic. Right, because of that chiral center. Okay, but are they enantiotopic? Can anybody see something else that happened when you made that into a D besides making this different from that? Matt? Yeah, it made the top different from the bottom. So not only did it make that a chiral center, it made that a chiral center too. Right? Now, if you replaced the other D down, if you made it H there and D there, you'd change the configuration of that center. Right? It would go from R to S or S to R. But you wouldn't change the configuration of that center. So these things are in fact, those two positions are in fact diastereotopic, not enantiotopic. So you might think, can that be really true? You know, are we just playing with names of what is R and S? And you can see that it would be so, because there is no mirror plane that relates D to H. If you drew a mirror plane across here, right, you could put that carbon in the mirror plane. You could rotate a little about around this bond, so that would be in the mirror plane. These groups would be down below in the mirror plane. Is everybody with me? But notice that this H would come out in front and that CH2 would be in back, or vice versa. So there wouldn't be a true mirror plane. So these two environments here are not mirror images at all. They're not enantiotopic, they're diastereotopic. And that's the source of this difference. That's that very, very small difference in chemical shift. And notice that that's only true of this CH2. It wouldn't be true of this one. Because if you did this one and made the top and the bottom different, then there would be a mirror image. Those are truly enantiotopic, as we showed earlier with the mirror plane we drew, right? So none of the other hydrogens have that property. Only this one shows that special splitting. Now, suppose this occurred to you and you wanted to prove it to someone that this is not a chemical shift difference, but is due to, pardon me, it's not a hydrogen spin-spin splitting difference, but is in fact due to chemical shift. How could you do an experiment that would show that that difference is due to chemical shift, not due to spin-spin splitting? Madeline? Can't hear very well. You could try decoupling, yeah. That would be something you could do, but it would be a negative experiment. If we're right that they're diastereotopic and therefore different chemical shifts, it wouldn't decouple. Is there anything else you could do that would be a positive experiment, Darren?
Could you increase the magnetic field?
Aha! You could go to a bigger magnetic field, in which case that splitting would get bigger in hertz, measured in hertz, same in parts per million, right? And that would definitely distinguish between them. Okay, I realized that question 8 was a hard question, and I thought people did pretty well on it. And some people talked about diastereotopic and so on, but I thought it would be worth doing this, because the concept is important not only in chemistry, but also in biology, where lots of surprising specificity happens that's due to diastereo or enantiotopicity. We'll mention something right at the end of the class. So those have different deltas, and you could prove it by seeing that it was bigger than 3 hertz at a larger field. Okay, now at the end last time we were talking about oxidation reduction, not in terms of direct electron transfer, but just as a nomenclature or a trick, a bookkeeping trick to use when you're thinking about synthesis problems. And the reason it's a trick is that you assign, and not something real, is that you assign the electrons in a covalent bond entirely to the more electronegative atom in the bond, which is obviously nonsense. So all it is a way of keeping books about how many electrons there are around. So if you wanted to do that transformation and you were trying to think what kind of reagent might I use for that, well, you might have memorized a zillion reagents that you could use for this specific kind of reaction, and then you just say, aha. But suppose you were trying to develop new reagents and wondered, I wonder if this reagent would do it. I wonder if I could do it with HCl. I wonder if I could do it with water. I wonder if I could do it with oxygen. Right? What could I do that reaction with? And it would be a lot easier if you could at least classify reagents in ways that you know that 2/3 of the reagents are impossible to do this with. Right? If you just look at a reagent and say, throw that one out, that'll never work, that'll never work, that'll never work. Ah, that one might work, so it's worth trying or at least thinking about. Okay, that's the application here. So the way you would approach that is to notice that that carbon has a plus 2 oxidation level in the starting material, but a 0 oxidation level in the product. All the other carbons have the same bonding that they had before and the same oxidation states as we went through last time in assigning them. So that the one on the left is more oxidized, the one on the right is more reduced. Right, so this is a reduction process. So if you're trying to think what kind of reagent might I think about using for this, you want to use a reducing agent, right? So this bookkeeping classification of oxidation and reduction is for purposes of reagent selection. Okay, we say, aha, here we need a reducing agent. So let's just look at a bunch of simple reagents and see whether it's easy to classify them as to whether they would be oxidizing or reducing. Okay, so we'll have three categories, oxidizing reagents, reducing reagents, and some that are neither. And of course, as we'll see when we go along, there can also be things that are both, or in fact all three. Pardon me. Okay, so HCl, how about that? Oxidizing agent, reducing reagent, or neither in normal interaction in organic chemistry. Well, we look at the oxidation level of the atoms. H is plus 1. What is it if it's bonded to carbon, H? Is it plus 1 or minus 1? Do you remember? H is plus 1. It gives the electrons to carbon in this bookkeeping scheme. It's nonsense. The electrons are almost exactly evenly shared. But for this bookkeeping purpose, H is H plus when it's bonded to carbon. So it's in its normal oxidation state with respect to carbon. So if you moved that H plus to carbon, or indeed if you used any acid in H plus, that's not an oxidizing or a reducing agent normally. Right, it's its normal stage in interacting with carbon. Okay, chlorine in HCl is chlorine minus, and that's what it is when it's associated with carbon. So making either of these interact with carbon or both of them is not going to change the oxidation state of carbon. Right, so HCl is neither oxidizing nor reducing. For purposes of this reagent selection kind of thing. I mean, it's conceivable that you could, that if you use a powerful enough oxidizing agent, you could oxidize HCl and make chlorine gas out of it. In fact, you can do that, which is Cl0, from Cl minus to Cl0. You can do that with a powerful oxidizing agent, but that's not the kind of thing you'd be doing when you're choosing reagents for an organic reaction. Okay, so that's neither oxidizing nor reducing. Now, how about Br2? What's its oxidation level in the element, the diatomic? Mike?
Zero.
It's zero, right? Both of them are zero. Now, what is it when it's associated with carbon? Will, what do you say? If you have a carbon-bromine bond, how do you arbitrarily sort of assign the oxidation level? Who do you assign the electrons to in the bond? Carbon or bromine? To bromine. So bromine is normally bromine minus, right? So if you take bromine zero and change it to bromine minus, it's taken electrons away from someplace. So it's oxidized that other thing, right? So it's an oxidizer. So Br2 is an oxidizing agent. And after we get through this stuff, I'll show you a specific example of bromine as an oxidizing agent. In fact, you already know of an example of bromine as an oxidizing agent, where bromine becomes associated with carbon. Can you think of an example? Yeah? Pardon me?
Addition to alkenes,
okay. So here's an alkene. What's the oxidation level of the carbon in the alkene? Yeah? It's minus 2. It's got 2 hydrogens. So each carbon is minus 2. We've already seen what reaction Br2 does. It adds. Right? But when you do that, the carbons are now minus 1, not minus 2. So bromine has oxidized that. Okay? It acted as an oxidizing agent. Okay, so we already know most of this stuff that we're talking about. Now, CH4, the oxidation level of carbon is minus 4, its most reduced state, and H is plus 1. Okay, now, So is CH4, so carbon, normally an organic chemist would not consider CH4 an oxidizing or a reducing agent. I'd put it down in the neither case, right? However, when I, and in fact, when I first animated this slide, I put it, made it go down to be neither. But on thinking about it a little more, I thought, that's really not true. The carbon being in minus 4 has a lot of other oxidation states it could go to, minus 3, 2, 1, all the way up to plus 4. So this, in fact, is a reducing agent. Can you think of any examples where methane acts as a reducing agent? And if so, what it reduces? How about gaseous hydrocarbons in general? Propane, say. Yeah. Yeah, they burn, right? They reduce oxygen, right? So obviously, certainly it reduces oxygen. In fact, the very name reduction came from carbon interacting with iron oxide to make iron metal in, you know, in the ancient times that we talked about the name reduce. Okay, or we've talked about CH4 reacting with Br2 being oxidized in a free radical chain reaction where you replace H by Br. So those are clearly cases where methane or other alkanes behave as reducing agents, but you don't normally think of them as agents at all, because aside from free radical halogenation, which is not what you usually do, there's no way to react with them. They're not HOMOs or LUMOs associated with, so they're unreactive. Not because, so that you don't normally consider them oxidizing or reducing agents, not because they can't be, but because they're not reactive, which is a completely different way of classifying things about how high, the reactivity has to do with how high the HOMO, how low the LUMO. Right? So that's another, arguably, much more important thing to consider. But for this trick of how you think about what reagents can do what, you don't think of alkanes as being oxidizing or reducing agents. Okay, but let's put it as reducing, because CH4 is the most reduced state of carbon. You're not going to use it as an oxidizing agent, for sure. And there are weird cases where you use it as a reducing agent. But I'd really be more comfortable if we put it down here where I first put it, but I'm not going to put it there. Okay, now, how about lithium aluminum hydride? How about the lithium cation in this salt? What's its oxidation level? Dre? Plus one, right, okay. How about the aluminum? So the aluminum is bonded to four hydrogens. Now, aluminum is less electronegative, it's a metal, than hydrogen is. So the electrons in the hydrogen-aluminum bond are on hydrogen, not on aluminum. So it makes four bonds to hydrogen. That would make it, giving four electrons to hydrogen would make it plus four. But it's not plus four, it's plus three. Do you see why? Because it's an anion. It's AlH4 minus. Right, so aluminum is plus three. Yeah.
How did you decide to the aluminum's oxidation number because of the anion? Why not?
Because the hydrogens, tell me what the hydrogen, there are four hydrogens in there. What's their oxidation level?
Minus one.
Minus one. They can't have any more than that.
Right.
Okay, so it must be the aluminum that gets the extra charge. I mean, it seems sort of arbitrary in a way, but that is the way you do it. That it's that central atom that gets the metal that gets that extra electron assigned to it. Okay, and as we just said, the H's are minus one. Now, are these normal or abnormal with respect to dealing with carbon? Are these the normal? Suppose if you had a lithium carbon bond, where would you put the electrons? Dennis? If you had a lithium to carbon bond, two electrons, covalent, substantially covalent, partly ionic, but yeah, the electrons would go in the carbon, not the lithium, Right? So lithium would normally be lithium plus. Nothing unusual about that. Aluminum, same deal. It's a metal bonded to carbon. Okay. How about the hydrogen? Is that its normal oxidation? No. It's H minus, not H plus. It's hydride, not a proton we're talking about. Right? So what should that be? H minus would become H plus if it became associated with carbon. Right? So it would give up electrons for our bookkeeping purposes. Okay? And that means it would be a reducing agent in organic chemistry. Is everybody comfortable with that idea? For this bookkeeping purpose. I mean, the whole thing is a little bit offensive because we've studied bonds a lot last semester. We know that mostly they're pretty evenly shared. They're just a little bit of typical. I mean, lithium is pretty polar bond, right? But normally, certainly, CH is pretty non-polar. But for this purpose of choosing reagents, we call it hydrogen plus in, when it's bonded to carbon. Now, how about sodium hydride? Caitlin, what do you say?
Well, hydrogen minus one is sodium.
Right, plus one, minus one. So is that normal, or would this, would we, where, what category would we put sodium hydride in? If sodium were associated with carbon in a bond, would it be sodium plus or sodium minus?
Sodium plus.
No, if, how about hydrogen? And where is it here? Okay, so there's a change. So it's going to be a reducing agent, like the H minus in lithium aluminum hydride. So that one's going to go over there too. Now, how about potassium metal? What's the oxidation level here? Mac? Zero, of course. And what's it when it's in a bond with carbon? Plus one, right? So it gives up electrons to carbon. So it's also a reducing agent. Now, will all sorts of things with potassium in them be reducing agent? How about potassium chloride? Is that going to be a reducing agent too? Why not, Mac? Ah, because it's already plus one, and chloride's already minus one. So potassium chloride, or most salts, in fact, or many salts at least, are neither one or the other. So already we can see, if you wanted to do this reaction on the top, which is a reduction, you might consider any of these reagents, but you certainly wouldn't consider bromine, HCl, or KCl. Okay? So that's a big help when you're up against it and you have to pull a bottle off the shelf to know which one might conceivably do it. How about RSSR, a disulfide? This occurs a lot in biology and proteins, the disulfide bond. Is that going to be an oxidizing or a reducing agent, or neither? Well, what's the sulfur? R is a carbon here, right? So that's a minus one, right? Sulfur we consider to be more electronegative than carbon for this purpose. Okay, both those are minus one. What is sulfur normally if it was associated with two carbons or with a carbon and a hydrogen? Where is it in the periodic table, sulfur? It's right below oxygen, right? So what would its normal oxidation level be in a... Yeah.
Minus two?
It'd normally be minus two. Here it's minus one. Right, so it would take on an electron if it reacted to become a normal kind of thing, depending on what you consider normal. So RSSR is an oxidizing agent. It can be reduced. In fact, we already talked about reducing a disulfide bond. Ryan, you nodded. Do you remember what it is? Yeah, the hair thing. When you have the disulfide holding the hairs together and you want to break it, you put in a reducing agent. You remember what the reducing agent is that we used for that? You could use these things, right? But I don't know if you want to put potassium on your hair, right?
Was it hydrogen
peroxide?
Pardon me? Was it
peroxide? Peroxide is an oxidizing agent, right? So it's not going to reduce it, it's going to oxidize. In fact, that's important to mention here because I didn't have it on the slide. Remember, we talked about oxidizing sulfur already last semester. There's an important drug. Right? The omeprazole, remember, where you put an oxygen on sulfur. That peroxide can do that to sulfur, add oxygen. It can, in fact, add two oxygens to a sulfur atom. One double bond sulfur to oxygen and another one. But so this thing also could be considered a reducing agent, right, with respect to reaction with peroxide. So you can see that depending on what other reagents you're talking about, this could be over here. But for purposes we're talking about where it's reacting with carbon, this would be an oxidizing agent. But the thing that reduced it to make the hair become pliable was thiol. So one disulfide became a different disulfide, and the one that was originally a disulfide became thiols and came apart. Then you treated it with peroxide in the second case and made it go back. But you could have treated it with a dithiol and made it go back. Okay, we talked about that before. So I've added RSH down here as a reducing agent. Okay? Because that's what it does here. And also in reaction with hydrogen peroxide. Okay, how about CrO3? Well, this takes a little thinking. Cr is plus 6 and the oxygens are double minus. Okay, but compared to what? What does chromium normally want to be? So you don't normally have chromium carbon bonds, right? But there are other ions. This one, where chromium is associated with OH and O and two oxygens, and it's an anion. And if we work through that the way we did with the aluminum before, you find out that chromium there is plus 4. Right? We could do that. Each of these oxygens is associated with chromium. That means they each take two electrons away. That two of them make chromium plus 4, right? This OH group takes another electron away. It's a single bond, right? But we have a minus charge, which puts that one back. So this one is plus 4. So we have the possibility of chromium being plus 6 or plus 4, right? So if those are the two choices we're working with, then this is the highly oxidized state, so it can become reduced. So it's an oxidizing agent, right? It takes electrons away from somebody else to go from 6 to 4. Okay, so CrO3, or relatives of CrO3, and we'll talk about that in the next slide when we get there, are oxidizing agents in organic chemistry. How about water? Brian? Okay. So they're normal, right? So water we'd put down here is neither. So you wouldn't try to do many of these reactions by the reaction on top, for example. Water is not what's going to do it. Yeah. Thiol is a reducing agent in that reaction where this became SH. Right? You remember that what people use who do perms on their hair is a thiol to give hydride to this and this from RS, and that other RSH that's donating the H minus becomes RSS. So it's an exchange of hydride between those. So one of them, this one which is donating hydride over here, is getting oxidized. Okay, well, water, of course, remember we can hydrate an alkene, both minus 2, and when we hydrate, water can certainly react with an alkene, but notice one carbon went from minus 2 to minus 1, the other, and got oxidized. The other went from minus 2 to minus 3 and got reduced. So one of them got oxidized, the other got reduced. No net change. So that's a reaction you can do with water. Or you can do it with HCl. You could add H and Cl to an alkene. But within the molecule, if you're going atom by atom, one got oxidized, the other got reduced. So the overall reaction is not an oxidation or a reduction. Okay, but for water, remember that one of the most important reactions of all, photosynthesis, which changes water into O2 and H-. Right? So the oxygen in water gets oxidized, and the hydrogen in water gets reduced to H-. It's not really H- floating around. We talked about this before. The H- goes on to NAD+ to give NADH. Remember, that was a nucleophilic aromatic substitution. And in fact, the last section of this chapter rehearses that again. Okay, so just to summarize, not all reducing agents would work satisfactorily for any particular reaction, like this reaction up here. So there's a lot of lore to be learned about which reagents really give good yields in what reactions and so on, whether they have HOMOs and LUMOs that can make the reaction work, like CH4 doesn't, even though we ranked it as a reducing agent. But usually you're wasting your time to try a reagent from the wrong redox class when you want to achieve a certain transformation. So when you want to do this reduction, you don't want to use these kind of reagents or these kind of reagents. You might consider these reagents. Okay, so that simplifies the approach you'd take, especially when you're inventing new reactions. But I say usually futile, that's a weasel word there, because as we've shown going through here, things can actually sometimes go other ways. But it's still a very commonly used trick among synthetic chemists to talk about oxidation and reduction, even in cases where there isn't an electron transfer at all, just as a way of classifying reagents. Okay, now, alcohol oxidation, the reverse of the reaction we showed on the previous slide, is the subject of 1614 here. But while we're waiting for that to come up, I'm going to put this central screen up a little bit. And draw just a little bit about an oxidizing reaction on alcohol that we didn't talk about. Suppose you have that's not in the book. We said Br2 was an oxidizing agent. So suppose you had an alcohol like say ethanol or whatever. Say ethanol. And now we know that bromine is an oxidizing agent, so there should be a way to go from here to an oxidized alcohol. So oxidized alcohol could remove two hydrogens, right? And we could go to this. That's the top carbon, and then CH3. So as far as oxidizing, reducing, that's fine, but there has to be a mechanism for doing it. That's really the more fundamental thing. So can anybody suggest a mechanism for using elemental bromine to oxidize an alcohol? What HOMO-LUMO are we going to use? That's what we do when we try to do a mechanism. Okay, what's the HOMO of the alcohol? Evan? Okay. And why don't you keep us going with the LUMO of the bromine?
It's a bromine
sigma star. Sigma star. Okay. So we can do this. Right? And that gets us started at least. So now we have HOBr, CH2, CH3. What have I left off? What do I need to add? Plus on the oxygen. And of course, there's Br- someplace. Okay? What's going to happen next?
the HOMO electrons on Br minus is going to attack the sigma star OH.
Okay, so we're gonna lose the proton. Okay, so these are gonna go on here. Now, Br minus could take it, but there are all sorts of bases that could move protons or take protons away. More alcohol molecules may be around that could take it. You know, it can go anywhere. So usually we don't worry too much about what you just say that we lose the proton. There would be cases where you might not have something that can lose the proton. Remember when we used these super acids to try to get NMR spectra of stable cations, we don't want anything that can take a proton off. But almost always we don't worry about where the proton goes. Okay, so I'll just take it off here and take away the plus charge. And now what do we have to do to get from here to the product? Yeah. Right. So we want to do this and have some base, maybe bromide, right? Back here. Did you ever see a reaction like that before? Not exactly that, but reactions like that where you, yeah, you can't hear very well. It's an E2 elimination, right? So these are very familiar reactions. This is an SN2 and an E2, right? They involve unusual elements in the things that SN2 is reacting at bromine, not at carbon. And the E2 is forming a CO double bond, not a CC double bond, but fundamentally it's the same reaction. So you have to have a mechanism to do it, but here's bromine acting as an oxidizing agent. Now, another oxidizing agent that we listed and that is shown in the book is CrO3. Right. Now, we can imagine an alcohol doing the same kind of trick here. Incidentally, it would be very hard to stop at this place. This is reacting with bromine too. But we're not interested in that and seeing that there's a mechanism that starts. That's the kind of thing where the lore is important to know that that's not what you normally use to oxidize this kind of alcohol. I'll just draw ethyl here to make it shorter. So we can do this, which is just like what we were doing before. And then we can take the proton off here, put it on there. Okay. Now, can anybody suggest what to do next? Don, you have an idea? Pardon me? Yeah, so we can have some base. Take this. So what we did was to, and this, you see what's leaving? It's HOCrO2 minus is what's leaving, right? And that's what I showed you on the previous slide is the other oxidation state one of the other oxidation states accessible for chromium. This is Cr plus 6. This is Cr plus 4. right? So it's gotten two electrons. Okay? And you can see what the strategy was in both of these cases. You bring in some element which shares these electrons, right? You bring in this element that shares these electrons, and then it leaves with them, right? So that's how it's taking electrons away from the oxygen, right? That's how it's doing its oxidation. It comes in sharing electrons and leaves taking them. Okay, sharing electrons from the target. Okay, so now chromium plus 6 occurs in this form. You can also add water to it. Not surprising, since you can add this. So if you add water, you get HOCrOHOO, chromic acid. Right? So another oxidizing agent that's mentioned in the book is chromic acid, or sodium chromate, right? Which is the same deal. Or you can take the acid, and or potassium, of course. You can take two molecules of the acid and remove water from it, and you get OCrOOOOH, right? Which is dichromate. Or dichromic acid. The dichromate, of course, is when the protons are gone. So all those reagents are really the same thing. They're this Cr plus 6 that can be attacked by the oxygen this way and then leave with taking those electrons away. So it, essentially what this has done is to change this H, which would normally leave as a proton, into something which leaves with the electrons rather than as a proton. Right, so it takes electrons away. That's how it's doing the oxidation. And it's true here, and it's equally true here. I'm sorry, I just saw my watch. This went much slower than I thought. So that's where we'll stop for now and pick up there next time. For those who came in late, the exams start over there, A through L, and continue here. Okay. I don't know. You could write that in, my email address.
I was going to take another photo. So, for question 8, they have like the two.
Just one second here.